meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. There's a new book hitting the bookstores this month called How to Raise Your Parents. And it proves that being a teenager or the parent of a teen doesn't have to be hard. It's the instruction book that parents and teens have been waiting for many years. And I have the author on the line with me right now, Sarah Burningham, from HarperCollins, William Morrill. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Dana.
Now, when you hear the title, it's a title that not only parents and kids want, but we all have to say, yeah, right. You figured this out. We've been trying to figure this out for hundreds and thousands of years, and nobody's been. Maybe you've hit the jackpot.
Well, I'm hoping I did. You know, it's funny. I came up with the idea when I was a teenager. I was 16, and I'd come home late for you, and was talking to my parents about various forms of punishment.
Okay, just a second. Hang on. I got to stop you for a second. You're 16, and you come home late from a curfew. I'm shocked. You mean 16-year-olds actually break their curfews?
I know. Imagine, right?
All right.
So, you know, I'm sitting with my parents talking about punishment because, you know, I'm the one teenager in the world who's ever been late. And they were kind of going back and forth about grounding. And while they were talking to me, I looked over and saw a book on my mom's nightstand. Mm-hmm. And it was something like Raising an Ethical Teenager. And I said, well, hang on a minute. You guys need a book that tells you how to raise me. I said, well, why don't teenagers have a book that tells them how to deal with their parents? I said, it only seems fair. So my dad was really funny. He said, Sarah, I think that's a great idea. You're going to have plenty of time to get started next weekend when you're grounded. And I didn't actually end up starting it the next week, but in my early 20s, I kind of revisited the idea and started talking to some local teenagers and realized that there really was a need for this.
This isn't a case where in your 20s you're still living at home and you broke your curfew again.
No, not quite. But, you know, my parents, I have to say, would like to think in their mind and probably still come home at midnight every single night. So
I love one term that you have here called parent speak. And I don't know if you've copywritten that term or not, but that's a classic. Let's talk about that.
Well, you know, parent speak is basically the all-encompassing language of parents. All of those phrases that every parent says to their teenagers and every generation of teenagers remembers.
Now, this is a family show, so we can't share some of those terms.
I was just we'll keep it clean.
All right.
You know, because I said so, or when I was your age, you'll thank me later. And my parents, actually, one of my favorite things, I can't wait until you have a teenager. My parents were teasing me when this book came out. And my mom said, oh, I just can't wait until you have a teenager. And she was razzing me and teasing me. But that's definitely a parent speak phrase.
You know, and why do we say that? I've said that. I have teenagers, actually. They're young adults now. And we don't say that about the 2-year-old or the 4-year-old. You know, we talk about the terrible twos and the terrible fours. But we say, wait until you have a teenager and see how you deal with them. What's that all about? Because that's a classic.
Definitely. I think every parent has said that at some point.
And when we do, I think it's just a way. Is that not a way for us just to, because we've run out of creative things to say, that we say, you know, like you just said, just do it, or, well, wait, you're going to have kids your age someday, too, and see how you handle it.
Right, exactly. I think it's exactly that. I think it's a way of saying, I'm at the brink. I'm at the edge. I'm not quite sure what else to say, but you'll get it when you have kids. You'll understand then.
Now, your book, How to Raise Your Parents, isn't just for teenagers. I think this is a worthy resource for parents, too, is it not?
Well, I'm hoping that parents will read it too, because I think it gives parents insight into teenage mind. I mean, it's written for teenagers, but I know a few parents who have sat down and read it with their teenagers, and they've actually been able to start conversation about some things and really kind of open a dialogue and communicate, and that's something. I'm hoping it's this tool for teenagers and parents to start talking to each other, because that really is the key.
Yeah, how important is that? If you're just turning in, well, you better be careful. You might crash into something. But if you're just tuning in, Sarah Burningham is here. She's a author of the new book, How to Raise Your Parents, and there's a link to it on the website, I think through Amazon. Talking, you're right. You know, parents that don't talk with their kids, kids that don't talk with their parents, they don't know what's going on. They're spending all their time on the internet. You know, we've done all the creepy kind of stories about what goes on there. But that communication aspect is gone from today that we used to have when you and I were growing up talking to our parents. You know, at that teenage stage, we know it all. We have all the answers. Yet our parents are saying, you know, whatever. And the kids are saying whatever. But you talk about negotiating and bargaining tactics in the book. Let's get into that.
Well, I think, you know, adults have so much experience, so much life experience, and teenagers aren't quite there yet. You know, they're almost adults, but not yet, and they're kind of encouraging, and they're wanting all this freedom. So I outlined bargaining basics and some negotiation tactics that I hope will kind of make up for that experience they don't have and teach them how to talk to their parents in kind of a more language. So one of the things that I suggest is that timing is everything. And I love this one because as a teenager, everything feels so urgent and important.
Yep.
But you really need to take a step back and think, okay, my mom just walked in the door. She's had a busy day at work. She just got a speeding ticket. Is now really the best time for me to ask her if I can stay out late tonight?
Exactly.
Probably not. You know what I mean? So if a teenager can think that, they're going to, number one, probably not bother their mother. And number two, when the time is right, their mom is going to be much more receptive to talking about why the teenager wants later curfew. If it's okay, then they will get that later curfew. And it's the same thing for teenagers. You know, teenagers are notorious for sleeping late and, you know, sleeping until noon every day. So probably the best time to have a conversation about what college you want your child to go to is not at 7 a.m. You know, wait until family dinner. And I think it goes both ways.
Oh, man.
Another one that I love is breathe. Because I just think if everyone can stay calm and take that deep breath, you know, count to 10, no matter what you're talking about.
You know, I'm having flashbacks here because you're talking about sleeping late and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. You know, did we do that when we were young? I don't remember sleeping until 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon and staying up all night. When I was growing up, it was, you know, you went out in the summer, you got a job, there was sports, there was all sorts of things that you got yourself involved in. But one of the things that you talk about in your book is why teens spending time on the computer might be a good thing. There's a lot of people are raising their eyebrows about that one.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think there's a lot of opportunity. Schools are using the internet for homework,
yep.
And there are a lot of really good things about the internet. But I think the most important thing is that parents get educated, because I think this is where communication really comes into play. There are a lot of dangers about the internet. So if parents, number one, know about social networking and understand what MySpace is and how to use it and Facebook, and they know about blogs, then they can sit down and have a conversation with their teenager about what is safe activity for online. What is the kind of information that you never give out online? You know, when is your teenager old enough to have a MySpace profile?
Yeah.
But parents aren't going to be able to make decisions or have that conversation if they don't really know what's going on. So I think step into their teenager's shoes and, you know, even let their teenager show them a little bit. And then they can make those decisions just like they would anything else in the family.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I know that thinking about, you know, MySpace profiles and online, I think a teenager that's had a conversation with mom or dad about what kind of photos are appropriate and what aren't is going to have in the back of her head, and it's going to click in before she posts any photos. Whereas a teenager who hasn't had that conversation might have that moment, might not have that second thought. So it's just like anything else in parenting, but it is the first generation, really, of teenagers and of parents that are dealing with this. So I think it's all about talking to each other and figuring out what's going on out there.
Yeah, and how important is that? Sarah Burningham is here, and her new book, How to Raise Your Parents, is available on Amazon and at your local bookstore. A term that you hear from teenagers when you're talking to them or you're disciplining them or whatever. And I can't remember saying this as a teenager, but I'm old, and maybe I just can't remember anymore. I hate you. You know, the term is, I hate you, you've ruined my life. If I had a buck for every time I heard that, well, I wouldn't be talking to you on the radio right now. I'd be in the Bahamas or something somewhere sipping on margarita. What's with that? They don't mean it, but it's is it an escape mechanism for kids? Is it the first thing that can come out of their mouth, or is it just this independent thing?
Well, you know, I think it's a combination of both. And I think as a parent, just like you were just saying, you don't have to put up with that. And I think that should be very clear. I mean, most parents are, on the other hand, not saying that they're teenagers, and they shouldn't be. So there has to be an expectation of respect. And this is one of the things that I talk about in my negotiation tactics, is tune in. And you kind of have to step into the other person's shoes. So as a parent, you need to say to the teenager, that's unacceptable. And we don't, I mean, I know this sounds old-fashioned, but we don't say that in this house. And then decide on an appropriate punishment. And eventually, I think you will develop that respect. I mean, there's always going to be an element of, oh, you ruined my life. Because they are, you know, as a teenager, you really are just learning about life and getting a little independence. And it's hard middle ground. You don't have all of it, but you're also not a child anymore. So I really think, you know, parents need to be patient and teenagers need to respectful and patient, and I'm hoping that as they read this book, they'll realize the better relationship they have with their parents, the more freedom they're going to have in the long run.
You know, on my program, Sarah, I talk about consequences all the time. And in today's society, we have more problems, I believe, because youth of today don't believe that there are consequences. And you go back to the Cosby show early on and the episode where Cosby's talking to his son, Theo, and he uses the, and I'm paraphrasing the classic line, I brought you into this world, I could take you out. And we can't get away with those type of comments anymore, or maybe that's not a proper way of saying it. We don't hear those kind of comments anymore, and there's that lack of, again, accountability with young people. They know that they're getting away with a lot more today, and they seem to be testing the system or their relationship with their parents. Am I stretching that too far, or is that an accurate statement?
No, I think you're right, and I think in a sense a lot of it does come back to parents, because I think teenagers will always be those boundaries because they're at a stage in their life when they are yearning for new freedoms, and they're going to see how much freedom they can really get. So I think it is up to parents to have a set of family rules and have, you know, rules that reflect your family values and enforce those rules. And I think that's the hard thing. And I don't think it's because parents are necessarily lackadaisical or too easy. I think it's everyone is overwhelmed, tired, and there's a lot going on, and we're all multitasking. So it's just, you know, when your teenager breaks the family rule, you have to remember the punishment that you've set up. You know, sit down, talk about the punishments with your teenagers long before they break the rules so they know what's coming.
Yep.
And then you've got to enforce it. And I think after a few times of that, your teenager will know what's coming and expect it. So they'll have that second thought before they break any rules.
And you have a website, www.raiseyourparents.com, www.raiseyourparents.com. I want to ask you about, you know, the media and young people today. Again, I'm not talking about Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best and the Brady Bunch and all that stuff when we were growing up. But today, when you turn on the television, what little hair I have left on my head usually stands right up on end. Some of these channels that you're going through, it's just absolutely wild, bizarre, crazy crap. I think I can say crap on the radio. Where today the kids are watching, you know, I have a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old still in the house. I got rid of the other two once they turned 18. No, I'm kidding. And I see what they're watching on TV, some of these reality shows, and basically a group of dysfunctional freaks, for lack of a better term, move into a house, and the freak that lasts longest gets $500,000. And it talks about society. It's a little different than going to the park and an episode of Leave It to Beaver. What has media done today to our kids?
Well, I think specifically talking about reality TV show.
Yep.
Calling it reality TV show is an interesting concept because
it's not reality.
Not real.
Yeah.
It's not what reality is. And I think that is the key, is that teenagers need to understand, and I think a lot of this does come from your parents, strong adults in your life, that that's not what real life is like, and that's not really how you make money and become a success in life. And, you know, I interviewed over 2,000 teenagers for this book, and I found that most of them are of that mindset, that they know what it is to be successful and they work hard in school. They were from all over the country and a few in Canada, and they, you know, all different backgrounds, all different family sizes, cities, suburbs, smaller towns. And most of the teenagers were very level-headed, more level-headed than I was expecting, based on what happens in media today. But I do think that it's important, with everything going on, that parents talk to their kids about what really happens. I mean, I can speak from experience. I have some friends in TV, and those shows are incredibly scripted.
I believe it.
It's unbelievable. They're not real at all. So I think that is the important thing to see. I also think, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, guilty pleasures and watching TV. But as a parent, while your teenagers are in your house, if you feel like there's something inappropriate, you should talk to your teenager about it. And not just say, I don't want you watching this. I mean, why don't you want your teenager watching it? And really talk to them and then listen to what they say, why they want to watch it. And, you know, if you're on the fence about something, sit down and watch it with them and then see how you feel about it. But I do think that if you're involved and you're really talking about everything, then you're going to come to better decisions. I just have one quick story about this. When I was in high school, I was listening to when Pearl Jam came out. And Pearl Jam is kind of one of those grunge bands. And I got a CD, and my dad said, I don't think this is appropriate music. And I said, well, why don't you listen to it and then tell me what you think? And he listened to the CD, and he came back to me, and he said, well, I think it's really terrible. I would never listen to it, but you're right. I don't think it's inappropriate. Like, I don't think the lyrics are inappropriate. And having him say that to me, that he would take the time to listen, made me really respect him. And then when I felt like he said something ever to me again about something being inappropriate, the fact that he was willing to take my advice into consideration and listen to it made me feel like a respected party. And I was willing to listen to him more. So that was a good moment for me as a teenager.
And, you know, you have those moments, and you talked about Pearl Jam and a CD. I had a similar conversation, but it was about a 45 and Kiss, so I guess I am a little bit older.
Right, exactly.
But, you know, Gene Simmons is still walking around on TV in his 50s, and I'm talking on the radio in my mid-40s, so something's going on here. I don't know. Anyway, the website is www.raiseyourparents.com. The book is How to Raise Your Parents. There's a link to it on our website through Amazon, and I assume you can get it at all the bookstores. Sarah, just before I let you go, I've got about 1 minute, and if you were to give advice to a teen and a parent about how to sit down and get through this, what you call parent speak, what would that be?
I think we should take it outside. And by that I mean find kind of a neutral location, whether it's taking a walk through the park, going to get an ice cream. You know, get outside of your normal realm and really sit down and talk to each other and listen. But I think changing that environment a little changes things up, and it makes both teen and parent a little more user-friendly, I guess is the term.
Yeah, and that's so important. I don't know, can you even buy 45s anymore? I guess not.
My husband collects them, actually.
All right. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. That's Sarah Birmingham, and the book is How to Raise Your Parents. We'll take a break, and we'll be right back here on the Dana Pretzer Show on the Scared Monkeys Radio Network.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, your host, Dana Pretzer.
And we are back. I'm going to share with you an email I received. You'll know my next guest, Jerry Simpson, as someone who's been supporting and working with us here at Scare Monkeys Radio to help the McAvoy family. Again, I want to share this with you. Some of you may know I've been helping with the Becca McAvoy case from the beginning. It was because of what I saw as a repeated pattern of injustice for the victim. The public needs to be educated. My daughter, Reagan, was an All-American for Illinois in her senior year. She received a full scholarship for 3 sport women's colleges in Lake Forest. She comes from a small town in rural Illinois, but she married a batterer and suffered abuse for 8 years. On May 30th, 2006, she was brutally raped by him. He waited until she slept. He handcuffed her, raped, and sodomized her. He dislocated his shoulder and put his fist up her rectum. He confessed. He is a sociopath and he wasn't too smart. He was charged with unlawful restraint, rape, and aggravated battery. And if you think that that's the end of the story, you're wrong. And I wanted to bring Cherry Simpson on to talk more about this tragic story. Hi, Cherry.
Hi, Dana.
Nice to have you on the program. What amazes me in these sorts of cases, you came to me about the McAvoy case, and you are also a family member of a victim, and family members are victims too. And it always amazes me, and I'm so in awe of the strength that family members can bring forward, because this story of your daughter is just... it's heartbreaking, yet it's so disgusting because of the system and how it's breaking down. Let's get into this and talk about her case and what's gone wrong here.
Well, I think what's gone wrong is the system, in my opinion, does the easiest thing possible.
Yep.
And they don't prosecute the criminals for the crime. I mean, this man confessed, and they had all the evidence. They had the rape kits, they had the blood, they had all of her injuries. She had the handcuffs still on her when they got to her, and he was supposed to get 7 to 20 years, and they allowed him to plea bargain down to 3 years and 9 months, and he was put in on October. He was brought in because he just ignored the law. He broke 3 times. He's broken the order of protection. He just ignores it. And the last time they finally put him in was when he tried to burn my daughter with a propane torch. And they finally put him in, and he's going to be released in 25 days.
This is so tragic.
3 years and 9 months.
Yeah, this is so tragic. This is a big story, and you looked at, I believe you said 7 to 20 years, but the damn plea bargain comes forward, and I don't usually use curse words, but in this case, it is a damn plea bargain. But this is tragic. They called them orders of protection for a reason, to protect the victim, but he just basically ignored it. And what would happen, Cherry, when he would break this order of protection? Was he rearrested and taken and retried or nothing?
It basically all an order of protection did in this case, and my understanding is it would cost money. The money, there would be a fine yes, would be arrested, but he'd just bail himself right out. I think he didn't last very long. He was only in jail maybe for a few hours. And what it does is it documents that he's done these things. But now he's continued to break the order of protection for the third time while he's in prison. He has written her and called her with written family members, made collect calls from prison, and there's a no-contact rule. He should have been held in contempt of court. He should have been charged with stalking. He should have been charged with harassment, and he wasn't. He was charged as breaking the order of protection, and what his attorney has successfully done is just delayed this case. My daughter turned over all of this evidence last March. It didn't get indicted until May, and he was, all this time, he's breaking the law while he's in prison. He's earning good time credit, meritorious good time credit. Well, I found this out, and I just started writing letters like crazy, and I shotgunned all these letters out to all these different places, and good thing the governor read my letter, because he's the one who got his good time taken away from him. But he's still going to get out in 25 days. And he's still breaking the order of protection, and he should be kept in, what he should be, and my daughter should be given the ability. She hasn't even been able to leave the state because she's got to stay there for this trial. So the trial is going to be held. The pretrial is supposed to be held 4 days after he's released. Now, how would you like to be my daughter and have to be in that state when he gets out? He's mad.
Yeah. Okay.
He's really mad that he's been in there. He's been in there.
He's
mad that her mother has been writing all these bad letters about him.
Let's talk about the trial so the audience isn't confused. He's going to trial for what?
For breaking the order of protection.
All right. Okay. Now, for May until October 2006, it says here he was free to terrorize your daughter.
He did. Yeah, he went into church and sat next to her and told her he was going to kill her.
Ho. He went into church.
Uh-huh. And she sat in church worshiping God.
Oh, my God.
Come next to her. I know. My grandsons, he whipped them with video cables. He was a full-fledged batterer. He was battered as a child, and it progressively got worse over the years as the children grew up. And, I mean, ever since this has happened, I've read every book I can on batterers and what to do for domestic violence victims. And anybody who's listening that has a child as a domestic violence victim, don't judge them and try to help them to shine a light on what this person does. It's the thing I think that I have done the best to help my daughter, is to help tell this man's crime. They want to keep it secret. They want to fool everybody, which I think they generally goes across the board for most criminals.
It says here your daughter turned over 3 months of phone records showing that calls were actually made where he was breaching the order of protection right from the prison.
That's right.
Okay, we got to make this very clear. He's breaking this order of protection, and these protection orders are made to protect someone, but this guy is breaching it right from the prison. What is the district attorney's office saying to you? This is a sham, if anything. This guy should be spending a very long period of time in jail.
The district attorney's office has not responded very, very much. So, in fact, I've been told to keep my nose out of it. And, in fact, did. I didn't say anything for a long time, except I was writing letters to, like, the governor, and I got a hold of a victim's advocate and the Department of Corrections and the parole board. Dana, none of these parts of the system are connected. So the Department of Corrections knows nothing of what's happening in the district attorney's office. They were sending him up there for court, and they didn't know why.
Jeez.
Until I told them. I had to supply them with all of the phone records and all of the letters, copies of all of the letters. And by doing that, I got 90 days of his meritorious good time taken from him, and I got him moved from a minimum maximum security prison to a medium security prison. But and he got all of his, he's got no correspondence since then. But that didn't happen until November.
And it's after the fact, too. It should have never happened
right.
in the first place.
Well, and they still haven't prosecuted him on it. They're still playing games. What they said is that the criminal courts are so overloaded that because it's considered a misdemeanor, although it shouldn't be because this is the third time that he's broken the order of protection, it should be a Class 4 felony. They're saying that they'll just probably do nothing to him.
I'm hugely concerned when you were mentioned a while back that you were told to keep quiet. Who told you that?
The victim's advocate in the district attorney's office.
I'm concerned why the victim's advocate would do that, because this is obviously a case that needs to be brought forward. There's a huge flaw in the system when someone who's incarcerated for a crime is breaching orders of whatever, in this case an order of protection, and continues on doing things to terrorize this poor woman. Are there children involved, Cherry?
Yes, I have three grandchildren, and two of the two boys are from this man. This was my daughter's ex-husband that did this.
Right.
He's now her ex-husband. Yes, and he terrorized them. The 7-year-old sucks his thumb, carries a blanket, wets his bed, is afraid to get on elevators, you name it, he's afraid. And it's because of his father.
Well, thank God that you've come forward with this and are doing what you can, talking to the powers the administrations to say that this man is a terrorist, for lack of a better term, and I think that's pretty accurate. The consequences of this trial, it sounds like, are going to be a sham, but it continues on. Has the state, has the Department of Justice offered any sort of protection, or the victim's advocate for your daughter and her children?
No. I've contacted Tri-Nova, and they've been very helpful. Dr. Will Marling, he's a very knowledgeable man on victims' rights, and he has put me in touch with a few other advocates. Holly Franks of the Franks Foundation.
Right.
He's very good. She put me also in touch with a Jennifer Jenkins with the Illinois Crime Victim in Illinois, and she's supposed to be the legal expert, and she's spoken with Regan and has several concerns. We've also talked with Senator Halverson people, and they're willing to try to do something to help. Now, I mean, this all sounds wonderful, but I mean, these people have all, you know, we haven't actually had anything happen yet. And I mean, I've been doing this for 2 years, Dana. I have been fighting for my daughter's life for 2 years, and you know, there's some days where I just shake with fear because, I mean, it's a horrible, horrible thing to lose a child, you know, like the Becca McAvoy case.
Right.
But for 2 years, Dana, I've been waiting for this man to kill my daughter or my grandson. And it's just a terrible thing to have to live with. And, you know, you grow up in America and you think that the justice system is there to protect you. And, you know, it doesn't represent the victim. It doesn't. It represents the people in general. And the court systems are overloaded. And I found out by speaking to the parole board that there's one phone in an office, one person answers it, and then there's one clerk per prison. That's it.
Jeez.
For the entire state of Illinois. Now, you're lucky they remember you or anything about your case, let alone, you know, be able to do anything for you. One of the things I will say that I found a lot of information out on, and this is for anybody that's out there that's fighting this kind of a problem right with their child in the courts, PrisonTalk.com. all the prisoners talk about what they hate and what's wrong, you know, what they can't fight with the system. And so I've gotten some information off of there, which has proved to be helpful. But it's a sad state of affairs. It's very disheartening.
Well, it has to be so troublesome. And again, this is a story that, you've run into so many brick walls that it's time that, and you've been so helpful with the Becca McEvoy case, that this case also comes forward to the media. Have you spoken to them?
How have I spoken to the media about any of this?
Right.
Generally, Becca McEvoy's case is a big case, and it involves children. My daughter is domestic violence. There's millions of cases like her.
And that's so true. The McEvoy case is so huge, and we're working day and night to get answers for them. But you know, and with a child involved, but darn it, Cherry, this is your child.
I know.
These are your grandchildren.
I know. Well, in the police report, I which is pages thick, and the medical reports, my daughter tells them that this man not only battered her, but the children. When I had to go up there, Dana, and I was wiping the blood. There was blood that went from her shoulder down to her waist in the mattress, sprayed across the wall, down on her hardwood floors, went all the way from the bedroom, down the hall, into the kitchen, and then out into the garage. I'm on my hands and knees with my four-year-old grandson, and he's telling me about how Daddy slams Mommy's head in the car door. I had to pull my six-year-old grandson out from underneath his bed at night because he refused to pray to Jesus because Jesus didn't answer his prayer. He's the one who called 911. And Child Protective Services came in, and that was they did nothing. He was on the property, and there was an order of protection. They don't do anything.
The DA told your daughter that if this dirtbag violated one condition of his sentence, he'd have to serve it all.
Yeah.
Okay, and he was allowed the lesser sentence, 50% of the lesser sentence, because this is incredible. Tell us why.
Okay, well, I was told, and this is something that happens a lot. You get told a whole bunch of different things, and you don't know who's telling you the truth.
Yep.
What I was told is that his sentence got cut in half, and I was told this by the victim's advocate in the Department of Corrections, because the judge forgot to stamp truth in sentencing on the disposition, the piece of paper. In other words, it was a typo on the piece of paper that goes from the judge to the Department of Corrections, and then they know how to what they're going to do for him. If he has to serve 85%, that's what truth in sentencing means, and that's supposed to be on all violent criminals. Well, because it was very, very confusing to figure out what's going on. The only way that I've figured out what's going on is I watch on the internet all the time. I watch the court cases by going to the circuit court, the county clerk, and you can see when they are coming up, and it has the case number, and it'll have what it's for, right? And then I would go always, and you can do an inmate search, and you can watch his date of release. And the date of release all of a sudden jumped from, it was supposed to be August 2008, and it jumped all the way up to January in November. And that's when I got very scared. My father had just died. So I had to write all these letters, and I just shotgunned them out all over to all the senators, the governors, the representatives, everybody that I knew in Illinois that might be of some help. And the governor did catch it and took away the 90 days meritorious good time, and that was based because I had included in the letters all of the proof that he was being prosecuted. Now, I wrote again and asked them, because I was told that this truth in sentencing And there was a law that I had the law. And you have to look at these laws, Dana. I mean, they're miles long.
Right.
And you try to read them, and you're just a mother and a nana. And it's hard to figure out what's what. Well, I just got another. I wrote the governor again. And I just got a letter back that said the truth in sentencing does not apply to felony battery or for aggravated domestic battery. So I can't get a straight answer.
No. Is there
that's what the problem is.
Is there an appeal process? Is there something that a chief district attorney or somebody, because this is a nightmare, you need to protect your child and your grandchildren, and it's more than just you being a mother and a grandmother. This is your flesh and blood, and you have to do what you can to help.
My daughter has put together a notebook, and she's so capable, and she is such a wonderful multitasker. She just totally amazes me, because through all of this, she lost their home. She's the sole support of these children. She works full time. She has them all in a parochial day school. How she does this all by herself, I don't know. I mean, she is living with my son, and my son does help her watch the children. But she's got this notebook together. Yes, she's going to, Jennifer Jenkins is supposed to go with her to see someone. But this isn't the first time she's been over there. I mean, she went over there just a month ago and sat down with investigators. I mean, I called Washington, D.C. I called the Justice Department. I found somebody that was on a grant over there that maybe wasn't, you know, wouldn't be influenced by who signs the checks. You know, their checks, and they were trying to get it transferred over to domestic violence court because they were afraid that the criminal courts were so overloaded. Well, if they get it moved over to domestic violence court, then it's going to reduce it to a felony. It's a class 4 felony now because he's done this. This is the third time. But the other question that we have is the bond and the warrant. It's going down instead of going up.
Yeah,
there's a whole bunch of problems.
Oh man, you know, I'm getting angry here because this is not supposed to happen. We're supposed to protect victims, children, mothers, in domestic violence situations. There should be zero tolerance for this kind of nonsense.
You're gonna love this. I called the Attorney General's office, and I asked to speak to a policymaker, and what they tell me is that they get a lot of complaints.
I believe
that this is more the norm than not. And that's the part that made me reach out to Becca McEvoy. I started watching that case, and I thought, no, this is systemic.
Yeah.
And then I bought Wendy Murphy's book, and I can see how come in my daughter's case, that's what the attorneys are doing. Well, then I also found out that Jennifer Jenkins says that there's a law on the books that while you're in prison, you can postpone. If you break the law while you're in prison, you can postpone the case until you're out.
Jeez.
Yeah, well, you want to know why I went on Prison Talk and found out why. You know why, Dana? They don't get meritorious good time when they have to go into court.
Yep.
Poor babies.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Breaks your heart, doesn't it?
Oh, I tell you.
This is what's going on in our justice system. Wendy Murphy's got hit the nail on the head. And you know what impressed me most out of her book, and I'm only halfway through? Her dedication. You know what her dedication says? She says that book, she's dedicated this book to all the families that have tried to fight for justice. And this is the part that really got me. And to the silent ones who didn't.
Yep.
Them try because they had no faith. She's right. You know how many people in their right mind would just throw their hands up over this?
Yep.
And do nothing? No. Yeah, we got a great criminal justice system for the criminals.
Well, you, like other parents of victims, have such a enormous strength and compassion and caring, not only for your own but for others. It's just amazing. Cherry Simpson, we'll stay in touch. This is a case like the McEvoy case that we need to get answers for. Thank you for coming on. You know, it's amazing. It's just absolutely amazing that in today's society, a mother has to sit back and ponder when her daughter and grandchildren will be killed. There's something wrong. We'll be back in just a minute to give you an update on the Brenda Martin case. If you remember, Brenda Martin was the Canadian who was in jail in Mexico waiting for a trial. It's a bizarre case, and it talks about foreign nationals being arrested in other jurisdictions and the problems that they can run into. We'll have Paul Macklin from the Save Brenda Fund here on the Dana Pretzer Show in just a minute.
We're back with more of the Dana Pretzer Show on ScaredMonkeysRadio.com.
Okay, we're back. A few weeks ago, we talked about Brenda Martin. She's that Canadian woman who had been in jail in Mexico without due process, if that's a term that can be used when we talk about the Mexican justice system, for over 2 years, and at that time her fate was in the hands of the Mexican government. I want you now, or later, if you're listening to this on podcast, go to www.savebrendafund.ca. That's www.savebrendafund.ca to learn more about the case. And there has been an update since our last show, and I thought I'd bring Paul Macklin on from Save Brenda Fund to talk about it. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Dana.
No, I'm not being facetious. Yeah, actually, I am. When I talk about due process and Mexico, that's me saying it. That's not Paul Macklin. If somebody can stay in jail somewhere for 2.5 years, you can't stay in jail in Canada for 2.5 days without having to go see a judge or a justice and get some due process. 2.5 years, and now something has happened. Tell us about that.
Well, what has happened is that they had a hearing. It's a very unconventional hearing because, in fact, what happens is that you have a file opened and the defense and the prosecutor contribute to the file. Then the file is handed to the judge who makes a decision. Now, you do have an opportunity as the accused to make, it appears, at least two, pleas to the judge as to what you think should be your disposition. But in the end, the judge just decides what he is going to do with you and declares that to be so. So what we had was, we had a hearing. It was disclosed at the hearing that there was no direct evidence linking Brenda to the charges, so that everything they were doing was based on strictly circumstantial or guilt by association evidence. And I think what makes it difficult is the fact that they have a presumption of guilt.
Right.
So once you're charged, you're considered guilty, and therefore the next step in the process at the end of this is not to get a verdict per se. They actually say that you're going to be sentenced. It always sounds from the beginning that there is really no opportunity for you to defend yourself. That's not totally accurate, but it certainly is extraordinarily limited by Canadian standards. So she was sentenced to 5 years in prison, plus a fine of approximately $3,500. And that was a shock to Brenda because she knows, based on, as I say, no direct evidence, that in fact she really is, by Canadian standards, completely innocent of these charges. But when you're in a different country, you've got to go by their rules and the way they operate. I think that each of us sometimes gets far too comfortable with a Canadian justice system that is very responsive, and then go into a country like Mexico and find yourself in a system that is anything but responsive to the accused.
Yeah, you say that is so true. And you talk about the sentence and the so-called trial, if you want to call it that.
I agree.
2.5 years that Brenda has served, is any of that considered to be time served?
Well, I think that's part of what is going on in the negotiation. If you look at the International Transfer of Offenders Act, which is technically the tool that they're using to return her to Canada, it says that the Mexican government has to agree, or the justice, has to agree to whatever time served would be allocated toward the sentence. And we're hoping that it will at least be a minimum standard of 1-to-1. Traditionally, Mexican justice systems don't give you any credit, which may be typical of that system. But clearly, we will be asking for, and I think they're negotiating for, at least 1-for-1, which would mean she served 26 months. And based on the way our system operates, that means she would be in a period where she would be eligible for parole upon arriving in Canada. If she got 2-for-1, which is very common in Canada,
right,
then she would have passed the parole stage and would be into the statutory remission part of a sentence, because it's usually the last third. If you've been of good behavior and performed well, that's just forgotten about.
Yep, absolutely. She would be released.
But she would be just automatically released. Now, we just don't know at this point how those negotiations are ongoing. Obviously, we'd love to see 2-for-1, but even 1-for-1 would be an improvement over where she is today.
What's the Canadian government saying? Or are they keeping it close to the vest because they're in negotiations?
They're keeping it close to the vest. The only thing that I can say is that I do know that Corrections Canada officials have visited Marjorie, Brenda's mother, and they've had a very fruitful conversation about how this could be done in the most humane way possible to work with Brenda. And let's face it, you know, I think there wouldn't be a lot of harm done if Brenda was confined to an institution for a week or so while they processed her, because I think she's got some serious health problems, and it would be a way for them to be properly evaluated and then give her proper treatment and so forth, so she would be leaving the institution obviously in a better health than when she came in, and we'd have a much better understanding of what issues she faces.
Has there been any timeline put on this, or is it just basically a wait and see?
No timeline, but you know, I cross my fingers and say in a week to 10 days, because I think we'd like to see this set a record for a Transfer of Offenders Act process. I may be a little over-optimistic, but to be honest, I know very well that the Mexicans absolutely do not want her to stay there another day. That they have found this case very painful, and they see it as quite an economic blow to them because of the fallout of people changing travel plans and deciding that maybe Mexico isn't the place they want to go for their next vacation. And it reached a significant level where in their major newspapers, there were headlines calling it the Brenda Effect, and we're talking about how this has risen to such a level that they are very concerned from a tourism point of view. And they don't think that this isn't obviously very helpful, quite the opposite, very detrimental to their tourism.
Well, at least they're able to sit back and accept that or realize that. This is obviously not the same sort of circumstances, but similar to the Natalie Holloway and Aruba situation.
Yeah.
When you have a foreign country, and it just goes to show you, Paul, that you just can't be too safe when you travel or when you go to work in another foreign land. Anyway, if you don't mind, I'm sure I will contact you again and get an update from you soon. And the website is www.savebrendafund.ca. Thank you, sir.
You're very welcome, Dana.
Take care.
Have a good evening.
Bye-bye. Yeah, and didn't he hit the nail on the head there talking about Mexico? Did it sound familiar to you when we're talking about Aruba? I have about 2 or 3 minutes left, enough time for a phone call if you would like to squeak one in here to the Dana Pretzer Show at 1-306-842-7884. It's not toll free, but I won't keep you on the line very long. Again, 1-306-842-7884. And I remind you, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. That's www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live. You can pick up podcasts, listen to my daily commentary, do whatever you like to do. That's so important because without you, we wouldn't have much of a program. We are working very hard on the Brenda Martin case, on the Becca McAvoy case, Cherry Simpson's case, all these cases. There's more and more and more of them out there. And I know the guys at Red and Doug and others over at ScaredMonkeys.com and everyone involved in wanting to help others that aren't able to maybe get the voice that they need. We do what we can with cases like this because they're just so important. Anyway, I want to thank you for listening. I appreciate all my guests calling in and remind you that we'll be back again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio Network. Good night.
Been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of ScaredMonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.